Welcome to Kind of Stirs, a show by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Hui Lee, owner of The Other Media Group.
Anthony Galloway, executive director of Arts Us.
Don Eubanks, associate professor in the School of Social Work at Metropolitan State University and cultural consultant.
Luz Maria Frias, executive coach and race equity strategist.
And Brant Williams, correspondent at NPR News.
So my heart is heavy today as we talk a little bit about three shootings in the city of St. Paul within 9 hours, three separate shootings, three deaths. And one of them was actually very close to where I live. And a lot of support has come out for the Good Samaritan who had come out of his house at night to help a car crash and ended up being shot and killed. He was identified as Javier San Miguel. There's a GoFundMe to support him and his wife and the three kids that were left behind. But the one thing that really disturbed me reading the story was the man who shot him. His mother was saying he was having erratic thoughts. He was thinking somebody was out to get him. You know, this was obviously a case of mental illness. And then to hear that there are two other shootings within 9 hours, I mean, I'm perplexed at the gun violence that we are seeing, not only nationwide, but I mean, here at home.
There's a big deal around this are impacts, right? A lot of gun deaths happen close to home, happen, you know, in a cityscape like this. And so those impacts reverberate, you know, and this has the impact of happening where a lot of them are happening together. The response, even though, you know, over the course of the year, these might have happened more spaced out. And so folks don't have the conversations like they're happening now because it happened so short. But these impacts reverberate beyond the incident and they're felt over time. I know, Luce, you've talked about this and that repeated historical trauma that happens with these over time. These aren't the first. You know, I was part of a visual for Dejon Johnson, who was shot at the BP on Hamlin and University. And I remember being at the vigil for that. And so watching the families around all of this must be a part of our conversation as we think about this, especially for the brother on the east side who's trying to help.
I think also one thing that really got to me was there's all the support that's coming off of Javier, which is great. I totally support that. But there's no support for any of the other victims thus far. There was one that happened. They don't have anybody in custody. They don't know the motive behind it. And so far, it seems like it was a random shooting into a man's car. Where is the line that we start to say he's a good person and we want to do something for the people he left behind? And does that have anything, you know, like Good Samaritan, quote, versus regular person?
That seems to be the tough thing when I cover these types of shootings, because often there are young people who are, they're not angels. They're hanging around people who are, you know, also involved in some things that are not good behavior necessarily. But none of those things are reasons that they should be killed. And unfortunately, as a member of the media, we see that, you know, the Good Samaritan story is, it's unusual in many ways because, as we know, homicides usually occur among people who know each other. Somebody who's randomly killed, that's very unusual. But also somebody who is, like in this case, was trying to help a situation and winds up being killed, rather than two people who, you know, are purposely engaging in a conflict and one of them pulls out a gun and shoots the other person. Those get less of a, you know, that type of reaction. But that doesn't necessarily mean to the families of those people who have died that their sons, their daughters even were worth anything less.
What I'm understanding from your comments and others here is the humanity, right? And having the Good Samaritan's humanity uplifted from the onset because of the nature of his conduct. He steps out of his home, actually, to help this victim of a car accident, and his efforts to do so is shot, versus then the victims of the other shootings where we don't know completely because the details are still being investigated. These are open investigations. However, the humanity of those involved in those is what's lost. And the question is, why is that? You know, and why is it that somehow, whether it's the collective narrative or some of it being shaped by mainstream media, that this becomes a part of the pattern in speaking about these shootings, is that who determines whose humanity is uplifted? Who determines whose life is more valuable or more compassionate than others? It is really difficult to stomach. We can't ignore that because that is something that we as society unfortunately have become almost deafened to, where we don't see that. We're not asking those questions. We're not finding out what happened in the lives of these youth. And I would go one step further and say, what is happening in the lives of those who are doing the shootings? Right. And what is going on in their lives? What are the hardships? You know, and there's a saying, hurt people hurt other people. What is going on in the lives of those who are pulling the triggers in terms of their surroundings, their hardships?
Well, and they may be also victims of trauma themselves.
That's right. And that's what I'm getting to.
More, yeah. Right.
Hurt people, right? Mm-hmm. So how have they been hurt in their lives in terms of trauma or violence themselves or lack of resources, lack of mental health assistance, mm-hmm. lack of medical assistance? There's a whole host of reasons that we don't know. I think we are too easily writing that off and not caring about it.
I think also this isn't the first shooting or first homicide, first murder in St. Paul either, right? Has our society become accustomed to not caring until there's multiples?
You know, I don't think that is the case. I've been sitting here just listening and trying to just sort through what I'm feeling. And, you know, the last three shootings that happened within, what was it, a 9-hour
right.
time span, on top of the mass shootings that have happened in this country, it's like the secondary trauma. So I feel for the victims, and I don't quite know yet exactly what happened in any of these cases. You know, I'm trying to prevent my loss of humanity and how this impacts communities, families, loved ones, regardless of, you know, it's not a question of who was right, who was wrong. It's the fact that in our society, this happens so often that I think after a while, many people, you know, become kind of deadened to these kind of incidences, and we're kind of slowly losing our humanity mm-hmm. with this stuff. And so I'm always checking myself. It's horrible, especially when it happens in such a rapid time frame on top of, you know, all the shootings we've had in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. I think it's important to look at some of the community response space too. You know, okay. Your question rises up, you know, to a person who's just hearing this from the reporting on it and consuming it that way. There's surprise. There's the shock of having somebody who, you know, wasn't involved in anything nefarious and is a Good Samaritan piece. One of the reasons I think that resonates so much is because that gets to folks' own personal stake of where, as long as I don't do anything bad, I'm not going to be involved in this. But now here's something that where somebody who wasn't right. up to no good mm-hmm. was involved. Yep. And so that compels some folks who might not have to think about these things, which is most of us. You know, we forget that if we look at this per capita, you're still 99.9% safe to walk pretty much anywhere and not have this happen to you. But we want to take it and react to something now. The conversations around the violence that has been going out between a particular group of folks in community in St. Paul is something that has been a conversation on the ground in community. There have been vigils. There have been conversations. There's groups of community leaders who have been talking about put the guns down all over the place and doing things like that. You know, before this was a rash that everybody was all of a sudden involved in and wants to now jump in and put a whole bunch of police at it in order to address something when that's something that policing is after the fact of this, right? There's other root cause things, but all of it's getting confused now. And there is a community response that's on the ground that I think, to your point, Don, in order to not feel deadened and grow callous around this, those events are happening and they've been happening during the evenings and in many different places all around just to make sure we don't go to that deadened space.
Well, there's also like a lot of people, especially after Javier's death, were saying, I'm not going to go help anybody if this happens in front of my house, you know. And so there's that response. And then there's the response of saying, well, the mayor needs to get, you know, 20% more cops on the street and they'll solve this as well. And that's not really.
Well, we know that's unfortunate because people easily conflate issues. Particularly, I think people hold on to sound bites. And if they hear it once somewhere, they don't necessarily check the accuracy of the research or body of evidence that's behind that, we know studies upon studies here in the U.S. and abroad clearly state that the way to curb crime is not to punish your way out of it or arrest your way out of it. It's not the law and order approach that works. It's the other approaches at work in terms of building the community up with resources, right? Investment in our youth, investment in their programming, investment in the health of the community in terms of access to mental health services, access to housing, access to food. I mean, the list goes on and on. This is a holistic approach that needs to be understood to be that and not going immediately to putting more cops on the ground.
Well, police officers will tell you, and they've told me, they're all with that. They're like, you know what? We're not the answer to a lot of these problems. We should not be called because, you know, somebody can't get their child to, you know, come home from school on time, or they're out with their friends and they won't come home. They're not listening to me, because people will call 911 for that. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but that's not my job. I can't do that. They're often called to do social work. As we've mentioned, you know, the amount of mental illness, and as we're seeing, you know, people who are struggling with crises, that law enforcement officers are only trained to handle these situations in certain ways. So, Luz, to your point, there's a lot of police officers who are saying, yeah, we would like to see other avenues for people to get help other than just calling 911.
We even have our own police chief in St. Paul. I'm a resident of St. Paul, who talked about this is an anomaly. This is unheard of. And, you know, regardless of the fact that he has a compelling interest to want more officers, even stopped and said, hold on, slow your roll a little bit. Let's get some information. Let's figure this out and not go down that road necessarily. And that's an important point that you bring up, because those interactions that happen prior, you know, police are a response to something that happens, right? And so just simple engagements before we even get to this point are some of the things that we're not paying attention to in the lead up, right? So if I know that there's this engagement stuff is happening here, I know there are kids whose time is not being used. I'm conflating right there, because youth are often not involved. We actually have a decrease in the amount of youth that are involved in serious issues like this. This is a grown up thing, even though in this case there were some youth involved. But it's hard to piece those things apart, because you want to hurry up and make a trend on something.
But young people grow up to be adults too. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's a continuum. And and you run a very successful nonprofit arts program that has folks understand the importance of finding the value of something, a passion they have in their life. And as we think about the various investments that our society undertakes, you know, by way of public policy, whether it's at the local level, state level, or federal level, we know that there is a pattern of cutting these other programs, cutting resources to arts program, cutting resources to athletic programs. In the name of what? You know, there's a saying, you can choose to make your own choice, but you can't choose what consequences come from it, right? The consequences will be there. And if we don't invest in our community across the board in these other programs that I've mentioned, and resources, and empowering families to be able to function fully to their potential, we will continue to see it. I mean, this is, in my mind, in my humble opinion, a result of a disinvestment in our community by our policymakers.
Well, Anthony, and you mentioned something else. When we look at the response to this type of violence, one of the other responses that I think is also very common is, where did this other person get the gun from? Where are these guns coming from?
Yep.
And I think that's a question that, as journalists, we try to ask more and more. Where did the gun come from? How did this person get a gun? Because often the person who uses the gun is not legally able to have one. How is it that they are able to get one? I just think that's really hard in this political atmosphere to talk about the role of guns in gun violence. There is an interest of folks who do not want you to talk about the role of a gun in the gun violence. Often we walk a bit of a tightrope when it comes to, you know, media, when we're trying to address some of these issues. But people that I speak to in the community are very clear. They don't need guns in the community. They're like, people have all kinds of handguns and everything. There are people who have shotguns and rifles, you know, for home protection and whatever. And people have brought their guns from when they moved here from, you know, the rural areas. My relatives, you know, used to do that. But the proliferation of handguns is something new. That's something different.
So I was talking to my husband about this last night, and just talking about, like, the ease it is for folks to get handguns you know, people who might legally not be able to get one. It's so easy to get one. My husband actually said, should we learn how to shoot a gun? Should you and I get a gun? You know, and it's a real thought now, all of a sudden. Like, it's not something that I ever really thought of before, but it's like, if we can't even go outside and help a neighbor out, you know, it becomes frightening. But then at the same time, are we just contributing to there being more guns?
And your, Helly, your reaction is very similar to others after shootings occur. There is consistently a spike up in purchasing of guns and gun ownership for that very reason, is that people start to internalize that fear rather than, to Anthony's point regarding Chief Axtell's comment, this is an abomination. I mean, this is not what we see in our city of St. Paul, quite honestly, in Minneapolis to that extent. However, it will draw more attention and because of the proximity of the timing of it.
You know, the reaction for this, I can't even go outside anymore, right? We quickly jump to a space that the data doesn't back up. You're not less safe in St. Paul now than you were before, you know, and it seems a little bit callous, but go with me for a second, because the statistics haven't changed around number of shootings per amount of folks around, right? So I may feel momentarily more safe to take those actions, but my likelihood of being involved in it, I mean, this is hugely anomalous. However, what I'm seeing in, and I stay with the neighbor next door apps and all those kinds of things, just because I want to see the conversation that's happening with my neighbors, not face to face, but in these in these particular apps, and then the Ring app, because, you know, we're part of that. And the stuff that people are saying in response to this, it's become that kind of comment section web area where all of a sudden
I can't read them.
Yeah. After these incidents come up, I see this rise in really racist mental models come out of the same very people who are supposed to be building neighborhood with. But now I'm, this is another excuse to double down on something I think erroneously, what happened recently in my neighborhood. Somebody coming out and yelling at a group of kids who were bringing a lawnmower down the street because on one of these apps, somebody was saying, oh, here's a video of kids stealing lawnmowers. What are they up to and stuff like that? And thankfully, somebody else was like, no, they just got done mowing my lawn and they're bringing my lawnmower back. You get tuned and wired to start putting those stereotypes into action.
I think that ties into, and I think we may have briefly brought this up our last Counterstory podcast, but there was that incident. It was down south, either in Texas or somewhere, where three young black males were out fundraising
For the football
for their football team.
Oh, right.
And a white woman came out of her house, didn't believe them, pulled her gun and held them at gunpoint till the police showed up. And thank God the police knew who they were and arrested her. You know, getting back to what Hilly's saying, I don't like to use terms like normal. There are people who feel like that, okay? Because there are times, I grew up in North Minneapolis. I'm a product of North Minneapolis. And I go play golf over at Theater Worth quite a bit. So I drive through the old hood, right? And I'll be driving through the hood and then a thought will flash through my mind of, man, you know, there's a lot of shootings over here, so I hope I can make it through all right. And then I'll catch myself having that thought. And where is that coming? Because I grew up in that neighborhood. And unfortunately, you know, there's been shootings have happened throughout our entire lifetimes. But there's people will react like that. Now, does everyone rush to the gun store to buy a gun as a response of that? I think often people are rushing to the gun store to buy a gun because they think someone's going to prevent them from buying that gun.
That happens after mass shootings. That tends to happen.
I think it happens because all, you know, I think there's this, although, you know, there is a difference between AR-15.
Right. And that's what usually, that's the gun that gets the most purchases.
And
in response to mass shootings.
Yeah. Right.
But your comment about how, you know, the way that you grew up and how that kind of works with your mentality now, it's so interesting because my husband grew up in Duluth during a time decades before I was born. And they were like,
you can just call him your sugar daddy. Yeah, go ahead. Just call him your sugar daddy. We all know that.
And it was, I always tell him, like, I when he tells me about his childhood, I say I envision it in black and white. You know, because it was like, oh, the neighbor kid Johnny and I would go do this. And, you know, and so now he has to come live in the hood with me. And every now and then there will be a domestic disturbance at a neighbor's house or something. And he will just walk out into the street where I'm like, you cannot do that, you know? And so our mentality is
You know, I'm sorry. I'm talking about a fraud town. I lived all over the hoods of St. Paul. Right.
There's a guy outside. He's angry at his wife. You can't go out there and confront him. He's going to kill you.
I grew up in that experience, and absolutely we're going to walk outside. Right. I actually have a very flipped sense. I'm less inclined to do that in a suburban or rural space than I am. I'm going to intervene in this. I have done it, and everything's gone just fine. Fear of that, because for me, just in that space.
I fear that for him because I'm afraid that the attack will come towards him. But his view is if this man sees that I'm here watching, it will de-escalate.
See, I'm with Jim. I'm sorry. I'm with him.
Yeah, yeah.
So am I.
Well, you know, I used to live in the north side, too. For a decade or so, I was over in 26 and Knox, the Deuce 6. There were times when there was gunfire a lot. But there were times when I would have to go outside and I'd have to, there's some guys selling drugs outside, you know, right outside my house, like on the street. And I had to politely go outside and ask them, you know, could you just please move it down the street? You know, I can't tell you what to do, but just please don't do it in front of my house. Or some guys fighting on my lawn. I had to come outside and say, can you brothers just take it somewhere else? You know, it's like, please respect my home. You know, I was trying to be respectful to them, but I also had neighbors who were white who would try to do the same thing, and they would get called all kinds of names. Mm-hmm. So I understand if you're a white person going out in some neighborhoods, maybe you don't feel comfortable intervening in that sort of way, and I get that sense. But I felt like, you know what, I have to go out and, you know, take some ownership in what's going on here and say, brothers, please just, you know, we don't need to escalate this anymore.
It's all about context as well. I mean, I grew up inner city Chicago in the barrio, 26 and Trip, and
you just had to shut your street because everybody else shot their street out.
That's right. we got to get some street cred here. It sounds like that's the baseline. To this day, folks will be really nervous to go into that neighborhood. Yes, we had gang violence. Yes, we had shootings. And matter of fact, I had a friend of mine who, age 16 on a Sunday afternoon, Julia, a young girl, was shot and killed in broad daylight when she was playing basketball. And other folks who were shot in daylight and became paralyzed as a result, or even worse, killed. Even with that violence, I never felt unsafe. I mean, there's a code of conduct, you know, that exists in our communities that have, you know, there's a level of understanding. And so, was it dangerous? If you were to measure it by gun shootings and gang violence and tagging and all that stuff on its own, I suppose it would rise to that level.
In the aggregate,
on
not
paper.
Per-
yeah, yeah, aggravated, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But myself, I didn't. You walked and you went to the corner store, you went to school and hung out with your friends. I didn't feel like we had to shut ourselves, you know, in the house and avoid everything.
That speaks to one of the things I'm seeing now, and that is the community response. And so there are several community leaders who are trying to organize folks to come out because everybody's feeling this. When you look at not just the social media feeds, but the actual people on the ground who are trying to do work to say, all right, let's figure out what, because this is a small, these aren't necessarily connected, but in times where rashes of violence break out as they can sometimes, especially if it's gang related, you know, you're talking about a small group of folks where it's already an anomaly. Add to that the fact that it's happening in a space where that doesn't typically happen, and you lose the sense of this is the anomaly of this situation, and you extrapolate it to an everyday thing or the possibility of an everyday thing, and we're just not there. That's not what's happening.
You're listening to Counter Stories on NPR News. I'm Brant Williams. I'm joined by Halee Lee, Anthony Galloway, Don Eubanks, and Luz Maria Frias. We're going to continue our conversation about gun violence. And one of the other parts of gun violence we want to talk about is there's also been a number of police officers shooting and killing people of color. Again, we've just had a recent shooting, and there have been others this year. I'm just curious just to see where everybody's feeling about the most recent shootings as well.
So we had the Richfield shooting, that was broadcast on Facebook, and of course the video was quickly taken down before folks could see what was happening in there.
So we should name the victim, sure. Brian Quinones.
And so, and there was direct response from Black Lives Matter. Again, we see somebody who's, you know, and I don't want to use the mental health trope just because of the way it's being politicized by the president and many other folks who are trying to pull it into something different. The actual psychological research and data says something completely different than what some of the policymakers are saying in that regard, but that's its own episode. But when we were having that conversation at the center, because we break down all of this at the Center for the African Diaspora, and as we're breaking down that conversation, the question came, why is it, again, this disparity? That there's a willingness to de-escalate in ways with white folks who are going through mental trauma or whatever the situation is, even if it's an accidental ID or fact that somebody else calls 911 on something and it's erroneous. There seems to be a willingness to de-escalate with white or perceived white folks in communities and not with people of color.
We've seen it in big public cases, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen white men carrying rifles being talked down by police officers, whereas, you know, in this case, he had a knife and he was shot.
Within seconds.
So when I heard that this happened, when I read about this, I think I'm to the stage where I'm just like dead about it myself, where I was like, oh, hey, another police officer shot another person of color. Okay, next.
I woke up early checking out Facebook when I came across the story. Whoever posted it, there was a link to Brian's feed that he had posted. Mm-hmm. And so I normally don't do this, but I clicked on the link and his live feed came up. And so I'm sitting here early in the morning drinking coffee and I'm watching this young man. Never heard of him before, but I had gathered that was involved in the hip hop community and, you know, and was sound like very engaged in his profession. And he's just calmly driving in a remark about him, this being his swan song or something along those effects. But I remember I was doing something else because the thing said it was like an hour and 49 minutes. I'm thinking, wow, that's a long time. But about 2-3 minutes into it, all of a sudden, when I looked back at the video, at the live feed, I could see lights flashing in the background. And so he pulls over and he opens the door and he gets out. And almost within seconds.
15 seconds.
The officers are, you can hear them running. You can hear them kind of saying something and then just these rapid succession of gunfire. And I went, oh my God, this guy recorded his death. Mm-hmm. And then that's when I stopped because I realized kind of like with Philandro, I remember sitting there thinking, my God, he didn't look black. His name, you know, I didn't know he was Latino. So I'm thinking, what caused the police to shoot this young man other than the fact he had on a hoodie? Right? So my mind went immediately to Jason Soul and his whole movement to humanize my hoodie. For me, it was like the police react to the fact that here's this young man hopping out of the car in a hoodie because they couldn't really see who he looked like or even what he was, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, there a couple of thoughts came to mind. One is to the fact pattern here is very similar to Laquan McDonald, a young teenager who was shot 16 times in Chicago. Mm. And police, they lied about the facts of the shooting from the onset and then were caught trying to erase videotape of the shooting that captured the actual, you know, circumstances in a nearby restaurant. And then actually some folks were, officers were indicted. That came to mind immediately because Laquan also had a knife, but he was not charging the police, yep. As the police first asserted. The other thing that came to mind was a video that went viral on social media of Matthew Thomas Bernard, 18-year-old white man who police allege Thomas Bernard killed his mother, sister, and sister's child with a shotgun. What was bizarre about this was that this man, this 18-year-old, was filmed running around nude, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. He was running around nude. This is something that happened in Virginia just last month in August in Keeling, Virginia. And yet the police very patiently de-escalated the situation. You know, he has killed three people, eventually tasered him. But in the process, this assailant also was choking somebody else, a groundskeeper. Despite all the, you know, the warning signs, so to speak, that community are seeing that here's someone who shot and killed three people, here's someone who's assaulting yet another person, choking him, the police found it within their means, if you will, to de-escalate the situation and arrest them alive, much different than what we're seeing in communities of color.
I don't think examples are lacking of the different ways that communities of color and the white folks are being treated by police, right? I mean, it's just there's so many examples out there now that you can't deny that there's this difference.
From the mundane to the high impact, you know, across the board. It can be lost a little bit because this is designed to be a, you know, to mimic some of the conversations we have in community amongst each other here on Counter Stories of People of Color, breaking some of these things down. I don't want it to get lost. I'm happy that there was a positive de-escalation that preserved human life and an interaction with the police officer.
Right, right.
Yes. Nobody disputes that at all. But
absolutely.
One of the things, to the point you just raised, Lee, is that people will often assume that in a conversation that's trying to pull out disparity, as if we would rather have that person killed.
Right.
That's not the case.
Right.
That's exactly.
We, you know, just be clear about the want. We want folks to be de-escalated in the same way that folks of privilege get de-escalated, and that's not what's happening. And we react, and that has an impact, right? So even when you say, I feel deadened or I'm worried about losing that sensitivity, that might be true on the instinctual reaction that is not true physiologically or psychologically inside your body. Everybody is continuously reacting to this and has a response that's not deadened, even if the surprise goes away.
Yes.
Anthony, you know, I'm really happy you brought that point up because I think often sometimes that nuance gets lost with some of folks who might listen to our Counter Stories podcast when we don't mention that, because when we bring these things up, we don't want it to be misconstrued that we thought this individual should have been shot by the police. No, it's the fact that they had the patience to de-escalate that situation. And all we're saying is, why doesn't that happen for us in similar type circumstances? That's all we're saying. And is that because we can see how the police can successfully do that. I think there are times when even in the white community, that doesn't work. There was a young man who, you know, his parents called and the police showed up and they were unable to de-escalate that situation and he was shot and killed.
And we're saying we want to see the de-escalation tactics that
exactly.
Now, there are things when we pull away from these conversations without that nuance, without thinking about this from a data standpoint, where we perpetuate some of the things that set people up. Because, you know, just recently I was at an organization called Save Our Sons, and we were at their annual fundraiser, and they awarded up the Ramsey County Sheriff, who, in a situation which had all the trappings of being absolutely horrible, a Somali boy, confused, had a weapon of some sort, and this female officer, I think that must be said in here, because I have a belief about that being a factor in here, was able to notice all those signs because of the conversations and the nuance that was in there and use that as she began to figure out, okay, there's a whole lot of things going on here. I need to get ahead of, right? She didn't put herself in harm's way to do it. A lot of what you hear in the reactionary side of the conversation. And it's really important to me that we have a space to not just hold accountability and call out the disparity and the inequity of it. We got to have a more complicated conversation is basically what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Because we're not doing that. We're not having that complicated conversation.
So if I...
Well, if we also think about...
What was coming up?
Well, I was going to flip around a little bit. And it's not necessarily a case of a shooting. Mm-hmm. But recently in North Minneapolis, we had an incident where an older white male was in the parking lot in a kind of a strip mall on Broadway Avenue, and used his vehicle to drive up on the sidewalk, run into a bus stop shelter, and how many people did he run over?
Six, but five were seriously injured.
Yeah.
And at first, there were no charges, right? I mean, so there were no charges immediately against this individual, and then I think, what was it, 2 months later,
right,
under community
pressure.
Well,
and that
pressure.
One was, yeah, and that one was, they said there were no signs he tested negative for any drugs or alcohol. If he had drugs and alcohol in the system at the time, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office said they would have probably been able to file charges right then. They had to hold an investigation that took a long time,
That was the summer, yeah.
Okay, yeah,
but wouldn't that just mean that, okay, so he wasn't under any influence, so then he just meant to do it?
Well, they still didn't have, this is what has been, you know, told me from the investigators, is that they didn't have the evidence there to show that he intentionally did it. They still don't know exactly if he intentionally tried to do this. But as you're saying, though, Don, I mean, the reaction is, and perception is very much reality when it comes to these things, that had this man been an African-American and he'd hit six white people in Edina, the contention is, no, they would have taken him to jail first and then figured out what was going on.
Yes.
They would have held him before letting him go if there was nothing else going on.
And it calls
and that's an, that is a very persistent perception and not unfounded.
Also calls into question whether that man would have been taken, a black man would have been taken unharmed from the scene versus this gentleman. This gentleman was 84 years old, if I remember. He was in early 80s.
He was in his 80s, yeah.
He was in his 80s.
And there were conflicting statements that he made about mechanical failure with the car, and therefore that's what he's blaming, cause of the accident.
Said that he'd pushed the accelerator instead of the brake.
Right. That calls into question the mechanics in terms of the investigation and the period of time it took to take there. I was going another route, which is a route regarding the issue of trauma in our community with any police shooting, particularly police-involved shootings, as we see them to be, where it's not a transactional, isolated instance, and instead it's a series of accumulated incidents of trauma. Mm-hmm. So if for us, it's a continuum of that trauma that continues to we're holding that. We're holding that trauma in our bodies, whether we are cognizant of it or not. You know, when we think about our children being out in the street, driving anywhere outside of the home, we are constantly being vigilant about where are you, who are you with, are you safe, and needing to hear. I have a friend who's an African-American gentleman who will tell me he calls his wife before he leaves to go to the office every day. The minute he steps into the office, he calls her to just say, I am safe, and then repeats the same routine at the end of the day as he leaves. I am leaving now, and then I am home safe. Because there is a fear that as a black man, he is subjected to that level of violence in police-inflicted shootings.
As we talked about in the first half of our conversation about, you know, in neighborhoods like another of my experiences in North Minneapolis, and talking with a lot of my neighbors who live there, especially my African-American neighbors, there were certain situations where they felt like maybe this is not the best time to call the police on these young guys. This is not, you know, because of that fear, that concern that it could escalate into something that could be
deadly.
So I think that, again, that is in that dealing with the historical trauma that a lot of people have experienced. It's like you don't want to contribute to somebody else's, experience of lethal force used by police officers.
At our center, we are located in a space where there are public courts to play basketball on. And there are groups of black boys who are always gathering in a space playing basketball or just hanging out around the car in our parking lot space and kicking it. You know, I remember interrupting a neighborhood person who was trying to be vigilant and protect their neighborhood because a kid left a fish head on the ground. Because chewing on fish heads is awesome for folks who like that. And it's tasty and it's just something that you do while you're talking to folks, right? So clearly, it's not a big deal for anybody else, but they wanted to track them down and like enforce some kind of rule because they left it on the ground as opposed to the trash further away, right? So I immediately go out to try to interrupt and educate at the same time, right? As I'm doing that, the boys are like, I'm done. And they're getting ready to walk away, but here I see this person in the neighborhood constantly pushing a button. And partly because I know if I push the button just enough, I can make this escalate to something that will make me look innocent and them look problematic. And I'm standing there watching this happen. So I immediately have to turn to them and go, don't take that bait, pun intended, right? Make a joke, get them out the way. And then I have to deal with that person, right? That in comparison to just a couple of days before, there was argument was going on. It was leading to a fight because somebody got fouled and there was an argument around it and stuff like that. And they were getting ready to fight. So I'm in there going to de-escalate it, right? Not same neighborhood folks are always around, but instead of going up and asking a question, doing anything like that, I immediately see the phone start to come up. Now I'm like, I have this window, right? And the tension I feel in the first example versus the tension in the second one, to me, were very much the same for me, but different at the same time. And that ability to have two competing things exist at the same time is something I see missing in all of our conversations around this that will give us to a much more real outcome and real dialogue that's not happening in the media sense or in the social sense.
So what you're referring to, Anthony, is examples of community policing. I mean, at a very, you know, a smaller level, but there are large cities around our country, and particularly in California, that do engage more in community policing because they want to avoid, Brent, the situation that you said, which is calling police and having the lives of their brethren, you know,
mean
their
like
neighborhood.
Alternatives to having police, having community members actually intervene.
Having community members, elders, and others to be a part of the problem solving, the dispute resolution, the conflict management in community. It's not for everybody, for every situation, but there are studies here in the country, in the U.S., as well as internationally, that point to community policing models that are successful.
The police aren't unconnected from those models, right? If I used to pray that the officers came around were handfuls of officers that I know from the community. The officer, when my car was stolen in our backyard, the officer that came up is somebody who I knew from community. He was a Hmong officer who I knew from the community. And so as we're talking, you know, he walks up, sees it's me, and goes, oh, okay. And now we have a whole lot of other points of contact to have and things that we don't have to lose in translation because we have that connection, right? If I know that an officer has had five positive interactions before any of the negative ones with my youth at my center, then my nervousness and the tension and the stress that rises when officers are involved in our space drops a little bit because I know that you've got a couple of other things that you're going to go through in a thought process before your action.
Right, but you have that. You know those community officers because you run an organization in community, like everyday people.
I'm talking about knowing the officer, I'm talking about when I was growing up. Like I had, there were some officers, if we knew them, we saw them 15 times and we saw them and they were from the area or at least they had spent more time in the area. And my first interaction wasn't the situation. It was in something that was fun, positive, all those kinds of things. The interactions and the outcomes in engaging with those officers are very different than the folks we'd never seen before who are very clearly were coming with all these assumptions that get juiced up when we have simplified conversations.
And I think that, I mean, in my personal experience, that's what I see more of, you know, one thing that we talk a lot, because I live by Lake Phelan, one thing we do talk a lot about is like, why aren't the cops just walking around hanging out, right? It's a beautiful day, you know, and there's lots of families, lots of people out. And so when something happens and it's always a different police person that I've always had to deal with. And a lot of times, a lot of them was like, I couldn't find your house. And I'm like, I'm on a major street. Right.
Major thoroughfare. Yeah.
Well, as major as it can be, right across the street from a park.
Yeah. Well,
don't tell people that. Dang.
And therein lies the argument that you'll hear police chiefs say that's why they want to have more cops, because they have cops that are out responding to 911 calls and they don't have them available to walk the beats and just interact with people on everyday matters. So, and that's what they'll say, you know, well, why we need more officers.
And I challenge that. And I've done quite a bit of public policy work in public safety. And what Hali is referring to is what's called community policing and being able then to know the police and establish relationship with residents, between police officers and residents. And that's why, you know, they're calling beat police, where officers would actually walk the neighborhood and establish relationships with folks. But those days are limited. You know, the culture within the departments have changed. It's easier to be in a car. You know, it's easier because of the weather. It's easier because of a whole lot of other reasons that'll be raised. But there is a necessity to have the community policing culture really be community. You know, Anthony, you referred to relationship building as a youth that was not confrontational. So whether it's through the police athletic leagues that they have, or, you know, the summer basketball police have with youth, or any a variety of ways, those are all very effective ways to do community policing and establish relationships. There are programs around the world where they really invest a lot of time. There are programs where police officers every day go to schools after schools, and they have game days every single day of the week. Police are at the school for the purpose of hanging out with kids, playing dodgeball, playing Monopoly, a whole set of games for the purpose of establishing relationships.
Well, that would be a good idea with the new St. Paul, start time for the schools, having more time after school. That would be a great idea for our police chief.
And when you speak to those, you know, it gets me thinking, the call for more officers, right? I have no problem with the staff of the police force increasing, with folks who have a different assignment other than policing. I have family members who are police officers who came in during a time when officers weren't called police. They were called peace officers, not police officers, because our goal was to try to figure out a way to restore things back to peace, right? And so I've got no problem with extra folks being on the streets, but not in a role of policing. If they're in a role of something else that's actually getting at the root cause of things, I have no problem with that. But the idea of policing, if we could turn that inwardly and police some of these conversations to get more nuance with more information and data, this reactionary space is using up all the oxygen and doesn't allow for anything to be built.
I was going to say the model really is about pairing up police officers with a mental health professional to be in the squad together as a tag team, so that when they're out responding to situations where there seems to be some mental health component to it, that the social workers or the mental health providers can actually help de-escalate. And they're trained to do that and kind of defer the enforcement, the policing part, to be secondary if the situation calls for it. And more of those models are surfacing across our country, but they exist on an international basis.
Thanks for the conversation, everyone. This is Counter Stories. I'm Halee Lee, owner of The Other Media Group.
Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of Arts Us.
Don Eubanks, Associate Professor, School of Social Work, Metropolitan State University.
Luz Maria Frias, Executive Coach and Race Equity Strategist.
And Brant Williams, Correspondent at Minnesota Public Radio News.